Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from nature.com, a mini liver will grow in a person's own lymph node in a bold new trial.
Ooh.
Ow.
Yeah, bold is kind of an understatement there if you really think about what we're talking about here. But here's what they did. Researchers injected healthy liver cells from a donor into a lymph node in the upper abdomen of the person with liver failure. The idea is that in several months, the cells will multiply and take over the lymph node to form a structure that can perform the blood filtering duties of the person's failing liver.
Hmm.
What?
Yeah. So it's like we're rerouting with a new organ.
Right. Like this isn't we grow an ear on the back of a mouse and then move it to you. It stays where you put it. And I guess you don't need that lymph node.
As far as we know.
Well, we have many lymph nodes. And that's part of why this approach is being looked at. Let's see. Valerie Guan-Evans, a liver regeneration specialist at Boston University, who is not involved with the company, calls it a very bold and incredibly innovative idea. But why are we doing this? Well, we have an organ shortage. We have about 1,000 people in the U.S. that die every year waiting for a transplant, and thousands more are not eligible because they are too ill to undergo the procedure, which in itself is a huge bodily trauma, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Legenesis has been trialing an approach that could help people in this situation and make use of donated livers that would otherwise go to waste because a person on the transplant waiting list with a compatible health profile hasn't materialized, because that is the other part of the timing factor.
Mm.
So the company strategy delivers the donor cells through a tube in the throat, injecting them into a lymph node near the liver. Now, lymph nodes, which also filter waste in the body, apparently these are ideal locations for growing mini livers because they get a large supply of blood and there are hundreds of them throughout the body. So if a few are being taken over to make mini livers, the rest can still function as lymph nodes. And the treatment has so far worked in mice, dogs, pigs, because that came before the human clinical trials.
Yeah, if you're testing it on a human, you've done something already. That's true.
Yeah, those are the species we have already checkmarked on this, I guess. And there they found miniature livers forming within 2 months. They had a cellular architecture resembling a healthy liver. They even found cells that transport bile. And in this case, they saw no buildup of bile acid, suggesting that the mini organs were in fact processing the fluid. Now, there is reason to think that the organs will not grow indefinitely in the lymph nodes because these mini organs rely on chemical distress signals from the failing liver to grow. So once the new organs have stabilized blood filtering, they will stop growing because that distress signal goes away. But it's not yet clear precisely how large the mini livers will become in humans, which to me seems like a pretty big question mark. But
yeah,
that's why we are doing clinical trials. And the company aims to enroll 12 people into the phase 2 trial by mid-2025. They hope to publish results the following year. And it's not only going to measure participant safety, survival time, and quality of life post-treatment, but they'll also help to establish the ideal number of mini livers to stabilize someone's health, because we don't really know what it is. Maybe it's 2, maybe it's 30. That being said, amazing science. This is kind of still a stopgap measure. So one of the most important complications of end-stage liver disease is called portal hypertension. And that's where the buildup of scar tissue compresses the blood vessels in the liver. And that can cause internal bleeding. So something like that, yeah, mini liver, they're not expected to address that. That's just sort of outside of their wheelhouse. But the hope is that they could be a stopgap until a liver becomes available for transplant.
The thing that concerns me is the bile. Because if you've got a lymph node with a liver under your armpit, you don't want bile getting released into there. That's supposed to go into the digestive system.
Who knows?
System.
Maybe that bacteria responds poorly to bile and suddenly you have self-neutralizing armpit stink.
Hey, take what you can get, you know?
Next link.
Next link.
So this one comes to us from CNN.com. It's titled, "A Billionaire Helped Bring Three Body Problem to Netflix. His business partner ensured he never lived to see its premiere."
Whoa.
Yeah, so Lin-Chi, a billionaire fan of the Three Body Problem, had big plans to bring his favorite Chinese sci-fi novel to TV, cinema, and video game screens across the world. If you're not familiar, The Three Body Problem is a sci-fi trilogy that has won huge awards. And so, flush with cash after the listing of his gaming company in 2014, the young entrepreneur envisioned turning China's most beloved sci-fi trilogy into a global pop culture phenomenon in the same league as Star Wars. But Lin, who was named as an executive producer in the opening credits of Three Body Problem, was poisoned and killed at age 39, months after Netflix announced its plans to produce the series in 2020. Mm. And the culprit was one of Lin's own executives, a high-flying lawyer who helped Lin secure the rights to adapt the highly acclaimed trilogy. Xu Yao gifted Lin a bottle of what he said were probiotic pills, but which contained a cocktail of lethal toxins he bought off the dark web.
Oh my God.
Media reports of the meticulously planned murder have gripped China, where it has drawn comparisons online to the American crime drama Breaking Bad. According to Chinese media outlets, it involved the mixing and testing of more than 100 poisons in a makeshift suburban lab. So, like, this isn't just, you know, hey, ricin, stuff like that. Like, this
super involved.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure he got the job done. Because so often you have a poisoning where it's like they get sick and they go to the hospital and you find out they've been poisoned. He was like, no, we're going to do this right the first time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. At least 5 toxins were detected in his body, including mercury and tetrodotoxin, an extremely potent poison found in pufferfish. Xu was identified as a key suspect and swiftly detained, according to a police statement at the time. And in its ruling last month, the Shanghai court said Xu had a dispute with Lin over company management matters. Xu also poisoned beverages in the offices of 2 executives he had disputes with, causing 4 colleagues to fall sick as well. But they all survived. He set up a lab in a suburb of Shanghai and bought more than 100 toxins on the dark web to experiment, often testing mixed poisons on cats, dogs, and other pet animals.
Ugh. All right, he was just crazy then.
Yeah, this is some true psychopathic, well, business partner, right?
Right. He's a business guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, business partner to a billionaire, a lawyer. I mean, you know, that Venn diagram is a circle. I mean, not really, obviously, but anyways. He then made the lethal substances into a pill, gifting the probiotic pills to Lin. According to Phoenix News, a Chinese news outlet, Xu held 160 cell phone numbers and set up a trading company in Japan to acquire hazardous chemicals, including the substances he used to poison his colleagues.
And he still didn't get away with it.
Well, hubris, right?
Right.
Yeah. The Shanghai court did not give details on the rift between Xu and Lin, but according to Chinese media reports citing sources in the company, it revolved around Lin's ambition to adapt the Three Body Problem, but the rights for adaptations of the books were held by a Chinese business couple who bought them from the author in 2009. In 2017, Xu, an established lawyer educated in France and the US, was brought on by Lin to solve the stumbling block, and Xu successfully secured the rights for adaptations, but Xu's performance failed to impress Lin. Soon, he was sidelined with key projects handed to Zhao Jilong, one of the executives who would later have his drinks poisoned by Xu. When Netflix announced its adaptation project of The Three Body Problem in September 2020, Lin and Zhao were listed as executive producers with Xu's name conspicuously missing. A source close to Lin was quoted as saying, "Xu Yao's contribution was almost zero."
Oh.
In an interview published in November 2020, Xu touted his key role in Yuzu's acquisition of the Three Body copyrights. He was quoted as saying, "We legal professionals are here to put out fires, break up the deadlock, and must have the courage to be the change maker." A month before Lin's death, the tycoon told an interviewer that the Three Body Project had the potential to be his life's legacy and would likely be on his mind when he said goodbye to the world when I'm 90 years old.
I mean, in his case, it was really a one-body problem.
Right, hey, right. Well, he only achieved one body. He was going for 5 or 6. I
mean, yeah.
Well, I guess in the end, he'll get 2.
Right, that's true. The state gets one.
Yeah. Next link?
Next link! All right, from The Guardian, something a little lighter. Everyone in Japan will be called Sato by 2531 unless marriage laws change, says professor.
Ruh-roh. Yes.
Though, like most headlines today, it's a bit hyperbolic, but it does bring up some excellent points that we'll get to by the end. But first, a bit of fun future thinking. Japanese citizens will all have the same family name in 500 years' time unless married couples are permitted to use separate surnames, at least according to a new study, which is part of a campaign to update a civil code dating back to the late 1800s.
So, like, legally in Japan, you have to have the same name as your spouse.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
The study, led by Hiroshi Yoshida, a professor of economy at Tohoku University, projected that if Japan continues to insist that couples select a single surname, every single Japanese person will be known as Sato-san by 2531. He does admit that this is with a few assumptions baked in. But the idea was to use numbers to explain the present system's potential effect on Japanese society and to draw attention to the issue. Because this was first reported on April 1st, but published in March, lots of people just assumed it was an April Fool's prank.
Oh, no.
But he wants us to know it is not. Yoshida said a nation of Satos, quote, will not only be inconvenient, but also undermine individual dignity, adding that the trend would also lead to a loss of family and regional heritage. And here's where he gets mathy. According to his calculations, the proportion of Japanese named Sato increased 1.0083 times from 2022 to 2023. Not much, but assuming the rate remains constant and that there's no change in the law on surnames, around half of Japanese population will have the name in 2446, rising to 100% by 2531.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a lot of assumptions, though. Mm-hmm. Like, if a bunch of people named Sato don't have children, and a bunch of people whose last name is Watanabe do have children, that's nice. You can project the line however you want, but I'm not impressed.
Listen, though, if this moves the needle towards any hint of expanding feminism or women's rights in the region, I'm all for it.
He's having to do, but he's having to do it with math.
Yes.
Right, because it's the only way to convince everybody.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Correct. We don't want to listen to your emotional argument for why women should have rights. We need logic, which means cold, hard math.
Well, you don't have to take the man's name in Japan. You do have to take a name, but 95% of the cases, it's the woman who changes the name. So while the government has allowed maiden names to appear alongside married names on passports, driver's license, and residence certificates, Japan remains the only country in the world that requires spouses to use the same name. Some countries don't even let you change your name at all. Most Islamic nations, the woman keeps her last name. But changing the law would, quote, undermine family unity and cause confusion amongst children.
I mean, the thing is, all of this only matters, like, the wife can do whatever she wants. If all the kids are given the father's name, it doesn't matter.
Right, which is usually what's happening in those other countries.
Yeah, right. I don't know that giving, I mean, the woman should have the freedom to do what she wants with her name, but I don't think it's going to change his projections on population if the kids are still given the same name as
the
father.
The name Sato. Yep.
Time to mash him up. We go, like, full German with, like, the list of your full ancestral lineage within your name by just, like, tacking it on and adding it.
Well, and there's certain Indian cultures as well. They will make a new last name for the child that is a mashup of the two parents' names. And it's not like a hyphenated or both of them together. It's part of one and part of the other, which just, it gives you a little freedom to make something that sounds good as opposed to just sort of jamming them together.
We were considering doing that, but our combination is pretty terrible.
Right.
Apoon. No, let's not do that.
Yeah.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we have one from The Guardian called Shakespeare Acted in a 1598 Ben Jonson Play, Scholars Analysis Finds.
I thought we were still debating and not whether or not he was real.
Oh, yeah. Listen, they didn't even address that here. They're like,
okay. He was real, but he was a liar. I mean, an actor.
Yes, he was an actor. And let me say, the title is wrong. We did already know that Shakespeare was an actor as well as a playwright. And in fact, we knew that he performed in Ben Jonson's 1598 play, Every Man in His Humor. What we didn't know was what role Shakespeare played.
And how bad he was.
Right, exactly. Because at that time, a folio of preserved work would usually only include a list of the principal players and not who played what. But recently, a scholar of Shakespeare studies named Darren Freebury Jones made the bold declaration that he had figured it out. And the way he did it was using an analysis tool called collocations and engrams, which is a way of comparing a number of texts to determine whether certain phrases are rare or unique. It's basically plagiarism checking software is what it is. And Freebury Jones's initial plan seems to have been just finding similarities between Shakespeare's plays and more than 500 works of his contemporaries, his thesis being that great writers do take inspiration from those who came before. And in fact, he has a forthcoming book about his overall findings called Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers. That title, by the way, seems to come from an insult that Shakespeare received in his youth when he first came to London as an actor. The dramatist Robert Greene declared in his deathbed autobiography that, quote, there is an upstart crow beautified with our feathers, who basically thinks he's better than everyone else and I hate him, is the gist. And actually, Greene's editor went so far as to apologize to Shakespeare about 3 months after Greene's death, saying he really should have just cut that part out of the manuscript because the old man wouldn't have known and it was rude. But as he was looking through these similarities between Shakespeare's plays and everyone else's, one of the patterns that Freebury Jones noticed in particular was that there were several borrowed phrases, not just from Every Man in His Humor, but from one particular character's lines in that play. That character is named Thorello, and he is a farcical, jealous husband. And right there, we have our first connection because Thorello pretty easily flips into Othello, which is, of course, Shakespeare's tragic, jealous husband. And, you know, just to be clear, Freebury Jones does not claim that Shakespeare was directly lifting lines from Thorello. But he does suggest that if you are an actor and you have deeply memorized a character's lines, the vocal patterns in those lines may drift to the top again as you're writing your own work without you necessarily realizing where they come from.
It's the musician who just wrote a great song.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some of the similarities he offers are perhaps a little tenuous. I'll let you be the judge. For example, in Jonson's play, we have the lines, "Sweetheart, come in out of the air. How simple and how subtle are her answers." Meanwhile, in Hamlet, Shakespeare wrote, "Indeed, that is out of the air, how pregnant sometimes his replies are." So, you can see the similarity, but it's not direct. Another example is Thorello's line, "Spite of the devil, how they sting my heart," compared to a line in Twelfth Night, "Speak ill of the devil, how he takes it at heart." And, you know, there's others. But again, Freebury Jones's big thing here isn't that Shakespeare had some lines that are similar to Jonson, but that all of the lines that are similar from this play in particular are spoken by Thorello. He also notes that very often the borrowed phrases include the ending of a previous character's line and then Thorello's first line in a section, which he thinks you'd have to work harder to memorize as an actor and to know where you came in. And also, he says in Shakespeare's day, actors were not given entire copies of the script. They were only given their lines plus the ending line of the character before them. So overall, he thinks this is pretty good evidence that Shakespeare's role in Jonson's play was, in fact, Thorello. Which is kind of cool to know, I guess. I mean, at the very least, I'm betting it does lead to a new production of Every Man in His Humor somewhere soon. Because as far as I can tell, no one has performed that play since 1987.
Wow.
Is it any good, though? Is there a reason why? Maybe it's just not great. And when you perform, you're just like, I get what we're trying to do.
You got the tone all wrong. This is a tragedy, a tragedy.
You rewrite this.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think Ben Jonson is a well-respected playwright. I mean, he's one of the few that we do also remember alongside Shakespeare, just not as good as Shakespeare.
That's such a modern-sounding name. Like, that could be my banker, Ben Jonson. What?
Right, right. Yeah. He didn't have the flair. That's why Shakespeare stood out, because he had a great name, and Ben Jonson is too boring and forgettable.
No X factor.
That's right.
I mean, I know a Ben Jonson now.
Right?
Right. He could be related. You know? I don't think so.
Great guy, just in case he's listening.
That's right.
But
well, listen,
it is a common name.
The question is, do you know a Thorello? Because
absolutely not.
No. Next link?
Next link.
Okay, from Live Science. We have talked about helium and our precarious supply chain of it, but good news, everyone! A helium reservoir in Minnesota has mind-bogglingly large concentrations.
Oh, so we don't have to fix our problems. We've found another Band-Aid to extend them. Okay, cool.
Well, it's hard to communicate the scale of this because it was...
It's a very large Band-Aid.
Yeah. I would almost say it's sort of like not even a mini liver, but like a whole laboratory of mini liver. Okay, let me...
Nice.
That metaphor didn't really quite work. But yes, we have recently discovered a helium reservoir in Minnesota. And they're saying it's got mind-bogglingly high concentrations of the gas that are even greater than they initially thought. So commercial extraction is what everybody's hoping for, because of course. Initial measurements showed helium concentrations of 12.4%, which, quote, is just a dream. That's according to Thomas Abraham James, the president and CEO of Pulsar Helium. But new laboratory readings have surpassed those results, and these new tests are revealing concentrations up to 13.8%, which those are the highest the industry has ever seen. Ever.
Wow.
And this goes into a little bit of why and how helium is so scarce, which some of our other coverage really hasn't touched on. So helium is the second most abundant gas in the universe, but it's scarce on Earth and only forms through nuclear fusion or the radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. So good God, no wonder. Now, normally, helium is obtained as a byproduct of natural gas production because it accumulates underground in pockets of methane and other hydrocarbons. Minnesota is just one of a handful of locations globally where helium is known to exist without hydrocarbons. The others are in Greenland and southern and eastern Africa. And that's because these sites all feature a crust of granite rock rich in uranium, and all you need is a dose of volcanic activity to then release the helium from the rock. And in this particular project, the helium has had 1.1 billion years to accumulate in there. That is probably why the concentration is so dang high.
Or they secretly nuked Minnesota at some point and didn't tell anyone, and that's where they're collecting it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is where we keep a lot of our nuclear missiles.
Listen, it's you got nuclear waste, you make lemonade, right?
Right.
Well, but here's another problem. Helium is notoriously difficult to store, and depending on the container, it starts to break down within 25 and 40 days after extraction. Now, most of the world's helium is mixed with hydrocarbons and wafts out of the ground just uncontrollably. It's just loosely flowing into the air, at which point the clock starts ticking to get it to consumers. But the reservoir in Minnesota basically could provide helium on tap because the reservoir is the storage itself. There's not that sense of emergency that you have to get it out right away. There would be no need for fracking because the gas naturally rises to the surface. So they're thinking a production facility at the rig site could then process the helium as and when needed, which would be a totally new way of harvesting.
I admit I'm a little confused about the breakdown time, because like we have helium tanks and they last a long time. So I'm not sure why you can't put it in a tank and protect it, or unless maybe they don't.
They may not last a long time, according to this. They start to degrade between 25 and 45 days post-extraction. So those tanks of helium that you see, they may have an expiration date of a week. A day?
That's interesting. Yeah,
I mean, I guess that's true. You blow up a balloon with helium, it doesn't stay up there forever.
Right?
Sure, definitely the balloon doesn't. I'm just thinking, I thought surely the tank had some sort of better compression. I don't know. I have an old helium tank in a closet from a birthday party.
Ooh.
I have to go test it now and see if it still works.
Yep, time to get some uranium.
Yeah, well, that's true. If not that, I'll get some uranium for the next birthday party.
Right. Or fill it with nitrous.
Yeah, either way. All right, either way, yeah.
Next link?
Next link.
This article comes to us from undark.org, and it's titled, Do Grief Bots Help Mourners Deal with Loss?
Oh, man.
You sound skeptical as you say it.
Yeah, I'm putting my money on no.
Yeah. Well, the title actually does have a question mark in it, and it is an open question.
Hmm.
The subtitles, Bereaved People Should Temper Their Expectations When Chatting with AI-Driven Simulations of Their Lost Loved Ones.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking grief bot like a therapist. No,
yep.
This is imitating the loved one?
Yeah,
that's not going to help.
Yeah, that's actually going to probably make things... There are like countless Star Trek episodes about this, surely, right?
Or Black Mirror.
Yeah, well-traveled in our sci-fi media.
Mm-hmm.
So, various commercial products known as quote-unquote grief bots create a simulation of a lost loved one. The technology is supposed to help the bereaved deal with grief by letting them chat with the bot as if they were talking to the person, but we're missing evidence that this technology actually helps the bereaved cope with loss.
Mm-hmm.
Humans have used technology to deal with feelings of loss for more than a century. Postmortem photographs, for example, gave 19th century Victorians a likeness of their dead to remember them by when they couldn't afford a painted portrait.
Hmm.
Recent studies have provided evidence that having a drawing or picture as a keepsake helps some survivors to deal with loss. But a strong continuing bond only helps the bereaved when they can make sense of their loss, and the imitation could make it harder for people to do that and accept that their loved one is gone. Carla Sofka, a professor of social work at Siena College in New York State, is an expert on technology and grief. As the internet grew in the mid-1990s, she coined the term thanatechnology to describe any technology, including digital or social media, that helps someone deal with grief and loss, such as families and friends posting together on the social media profile of a deceased loved one or creating a website in their memory. If companies are going to build AI simulations of the deceased, then they have to talk to the people who think they want this technology to better create something that meets their needs, Sofka said. Seance AI's Griefbot, which, what a name.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, that one is intended for short-term use to provide a sense of closure, while the company You, comma, only virtual, promises to keep someone's loved one with them forever so they, quote, never have to say goodbye.
Healthy. That sounds real healthy.
But if companies can create convincing simulations of people who died, Sofka said, it's possible that could change the whole reality of the person being gone. Griefbots could give the bereaved a new tool to cope with grief, or they could create the illusion that the loved one isn't gone and force mourners to confront a second death if they want to stop using the bot.
Yeah, that's what happened to me when I saw Tupac's hologram. I had just gotten over it.
Well, and I'm thinking, like, didn't Kanye create some sort of hologram of Kim Kardashian's dad for her birthday?
Yes. Ooh.
Yeah, I heard a story about somebody who was using one of these LLMs, like, I think it was very early on with OpenAI or maybe another company, I'm not 100% sure, to basically replicate old texts from his wife who had passed. And then when the service provider yanked it because they said it was against their terms of service, he was very upset. And, you know, he described it as like experiencing a second death, basically.
Yeah.
So I'll just say, if you're going to do that, there are open source LLMs. They're getting better. They're not quite there yet. But
yeah, don't pay money for it at the very least.
Yeah. At the very least, don't host your dead spouse or loved one on a corporate server. Right.
Oh, yeah.
You say that, and yet how many of us are in 23andMe, Ancestry.com?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, but I'm not hoping they'll store it. I've got it downloaded. Not that it's going to do me any good, but I also have my own data in case they take it offline.
There you go.
And I mean, the great thing about having your data on 23andMe is that it's been hacked so many times that your data is everywhere. There's plenty of data redundancy.
That was my gift to them.
Yeah. So to develop grief bots responsibly, it's not just about knowing how to make an authentic bot and then doing it, said Wan Zhou Shi, an assistant professor at the Kyoto Institute of Technology. She collaborated with Anna Zigku, a doctoral student at the University of Kent, and other co-authors on a research project to see how chatbot technologies can be used to support grief. They interviewed 10 people who were using virtual characters created by various apps to cope with the loss of a loved one. 5 of their participants chatted with a simulation of the person they lost, while the others used chatbots that took on different roles, such as a friend. Zigku said that the majority of them talked to the characters for less than a year. She said most of them used it as a transitional stage to overcome grief in the first stage, when grief is so intense that you cannot cope with the loss. They did not want to recreate a loved one to keep them at their side for life. Critically, according to Shu, chatbots are currently not under any regulation, and without that, it's hard to get companies to prove their products help users to deal with loss. As long as these apps categorize themselves as wellness rather than therapy, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration will not enforce its requirements, including that apps prove they do more good than harm.
Well, that's heartening.
Yeah. Though it's unclear which regulatory body will be ultimately responsible, it is possible that the Federal Trade Commission could handle false or unqualified claims made by such products. But no matter what comfort a bereaved person finds in a bot, by no means should they trust them, Shu said. When a LLM is talking to someone, it's just predicting what is the next word.
Yeah, I can't wait until they start promising like, oh, we've reached the singularity. We can upload your dead person's consciousness into the cloud and it will be them. And then if you find out it was all a scam, they were just LLMs and like you were never actually
uploaded. Or it happens exactly right. And you forget that people are allowed to change and disagree with you and have feelings and opinions of their own. And when that eventually occurs because time, how are you going to deal with it then?
That's right. You can't teach the LLM, hey, we don't say that word anymore.
Well, LLMs are not really designed to be static. They're learning machines. So they are going to change and grow and expand to some degree, right? Like even just throughout the interaction.
Yeah. And I'm also not just my texts and my emails, right?
Yeah.
So if we were to base a model off my texts and emails, I don't think it would be anything like me.
Yeah. My emails are a lot more professional than my real mouth.
Right.
So. Yeah.
And, you know, Replica, the AI girlfriend / boyfriend bot, that literally started as a service that promised to save all of your texts and emails and whatnot and replicate you after you die. That was their initial pitch, and then they pivoted, and now they do very terrible AI girlfriends.
Yeah, that's the pivot. That's what do people actually want to pay for? Oh, the girlfriend?
That's what people really want.
Yeah, so like, I do think that may be a road into, you know, grief bots proper if these get really normalized, but I mean, it's a scary situation. Like, these bots are not good. But if you go to the Replica Reddit, there are people who are forming massive emotional attachments. And whenever there's an update, a lot of these bots have their memory reset and people are going onto that Reddit like literally emotionally upset that their bot has changed.
So they need a grief bot to get over the death of their bot. And then we'll get...
Ayo, I heard you liked grief bots, so I got you a grief bot about your grief bot.
Exactly.
Next link?
Next link.
Okay. If you are listening to this while eating, you might want to take a break. This comes from CNN. Everest climbers will have to take their poop away with them as Nepal tries to address growing waste problem.
I mean, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So if you were hoping to climb Everest this year, you'll need to make some room in your bag because new rules now mandate that climbers bring their excrement down with them from the world's highest peak in a bid to tackle pollution. Which, honestly, I'm very surprised they weren't doing already, because the world's highest peak has a crap problem driven by the number of visitors and harsh conditions on the mountain, which interfere with the degradation process, which I'm assuming it just means it lingers for longer.
Yep.
Yeah, it's frozen. It doesn't go away like it does in normal weather.
The new monuments.
Right. Without the new rules, the poo problem was highly likely to get worse. Last year, Nepal gave out a record 478 climbing permits to climb the peak. Not to mention, which I'm about to, there are 12 climbers confirmed to have died on the mountain, while another five remain officially missing. A man from the Nepal Mountaineering Association told CNN that an estimated 1,200 people will be on Everest this season.
Wow.
He explained, each person produces 250 grams, 8.8 ounces of excrement a day, and that they will spend 2 weeks on the higher camps for the summit push. But there is a solution. Each climber will be given 2 poop bags.
What? Just 2?
Yep. Which can each be used 6 times.
No.
You know what? We got to be real sustainable and eco-conscious about the whole project, y'all.
Yeah. The bags contain chemicals to solidify the human waste and make it odorless.
No, because here's the thing. I've had babies. I've had those diaper genies. They're like, no odor. It's a lie. You can absolutely smell it. There is no such thing as no odor poo containment.
Right. And if there are, I don't know what chemicals those are and how bad they'll eventually be for the environmental impact. So when I went camping at the University of Colorado as a freshman in the 90s, we had a 3-day hike in the mountains. And we were told then you either pack it out or you dig a hole and that's it. So needless to say, I didn't poop for 3 days.
you packed it out just like they said.
So again, I'm surprised that something like this wasn't already in play. I'm just glad that they are now. And yeah, I'd also like to add that if you do go home, bring it home with you as a token of reminder. You know, put it in a glass case with a plaque or something.
Yeah. Put it in the freezer like a wedding cake. You keep it for a year just to commemorate.
Just to remind you.
I mean, I'm going to give it to my grandchildren. I don't know why y'all
are
so short term.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include the American swamp bird that disappeared, what happens when racing has no rules, and the world's biggest blueberry is 70 times heavier than most. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.